They want me to get rid of my dog. Can they do that?
I'm being fined for leaving my garage door open too long.
What are covenants? Do I have any rights?
Help, I feel like I've left the American zone.
If you want the answers to those questions, join me, Sue Bartholomew, and my guests on The Commons every Saturday from 2 to 3 right here on WEBR Fairfax Radio. We'll ask the experts and we'll untangle the truth about what's left of our property rights. On the Commons is a weekly radio show dedicated to discussing the many issues surrounding mandatory membership homeowners associations. Join us as we explore this relatively new world of controlled living, which includes condominiums, cooperatives, and both attached and detached single-family homes. Living in a common ownership development means giving up the American dream. It means giving up your constitutional rights and control over your most valuable asset, your home. Living in a homeowners association means leaving the American zone. This is On the Commons, and I am Sue Bartholomew. And joining us today, we have Larry Fletcher. Larry is in Alabama, and we don't often get to talk to people in Alabama because seemingly things don't happen in Alabama, but apparently that's not quite right because they're doing something really interesting. Larry, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Now, you guys are not trying to fix HOAs, you're just trying to fix your lives.
Yeah, we're trying to basically get them to leave us alone.
What a concept, Larry, what a concept.
Yeah, what happened is a few years ago, shortly after the developer had turned the HOA over to the residents, they had some fellows got into running the HOA, and they were very militant. You probably had never heard any of that happening before,
never.
But these guys were. And they started trying to impose fines and dictate where satellite dishes could go, which was in conflict with the 1996 Telecommunications Act. Just power grabs, overstepping their bounds in quite a few different ways. And we wound up having a lawsuit against them over the issue of fines, and we won that. And after that, I got to looking at our restrictive covenants, and what I noticed is our subdivision is in five different filings, or units as they're called here, but it's different sections of the subdivision, you know, that they developed it in phases. And each one of these units has got its own set of restrictive covenants. And they were not all merged together. And when I saw that, I got to talking with my neighbor, he's the fellow whose name is on the lawsuit. And his name is Bill Pipkin. And I pointed this out and I said, you know, Bill, I said, we can take a vote here and dissolve our restrictive covenants. And if we do that, I said, then they've got nothing to enforce on us. And I said, furthermore, they can't make us members of the HOA because that's where their power is derived, is from the restrictive covenants. So Bill knows everybody on the street, been here longer than me. Also is retired and has plenty of time to go by and talk to everybody. So he got everybody together and we had a meeting, discussed it. And there's 12 lots in the first unit. And 11 of us voted to dissolve the covenants and one abstained. And we needed a 60% threshold voting in favor. So we far exceeded that. Our vote with a notary came in, it notarized everybody's signature, and we had a big sign-in party. And we took this stuff and recorded it this document, recorded it at the courthouse, like we were supposed to, and we sent the Homeowners Association registered letter notifying them of what we had done, telling them where they could find it in the courthouse records, and that we were no longer members of their Homeowners Association.
You know what? I really love that.
Yeah, they, needless to say, they were not very happy about what had transpired.
They had no inkling until you informed them that you had extinguished all your covenants and that had been recorded. They had no idea what you were doing.
Right. They were totally blindsided. They had no idea what was going on. So this kind of sets up the scenario for how the fight. They being the Homeowners Association, what they did was decided it, all this happened at about the time some dues were ready, and I'm, as I remember, I think Louisa had already sent our check in for the dues, and some people had already sent their check in, and some hadn't. Well, the ones that hadn't sent it in yet, they said, well, you know, we don't owe the dues for this following year. And they didn't send theirs in. Well, the HOA responded by filing liens against these people's property. And so we rallied the people together again, raised some money, and went and got an attorney. And he filed suit in the district court. And anyway, when the dust settled on that, we had won that case, saying that, you know, our Unit 1 had abolished the restrictive covenants and we were no longer members of the association and didn't owe them any dues. And we were about to have a big party on the street, and you've got a period of time after a judgment like that is issued that you have for appeal. And I want to say it was about 40 days, and it was like the 39th day when they appealed and we got notice of it. And our attorney said, well, looks like they're trying to out-resource you. And that kind of made me mad.
Wait, can you explain what you mean by out-resource you? What were they doing? I know what you mean, but I want my listeners to know exactly what you're talking about, because that's a very common thing.
Okay. What this attorney, our attorney, David, what he had said, or what he had meant when he said they're trying to out-resource you, is that an appeal is an expensive process, and we think that the Homeowners Association was under the impression that if they went and simply filed the paperwork for the appeal, that we wouldn't answer the appeal and they would win by default. And my best guess is they probably figured, yeah, we can just file the appeal and they'll roll over. And we won't have to pay to have the appellate briefs written and submitted and all this stuff. It'll just be three to $500 their lawyer had charged, and they would bluff us. Well, we didn't bluff that easy. We got together and talked about it. We had quite a few people that didn't want to pursue it any further. And there's some other flaws in the way that the nonprofit corporation that the HOA is set up that exposes the board members to personal liability. And another friend of mine who's an attorney, he is interested in going after them personally. And so that's when I decided, you know what? Whatever the rest of them don't put up, I'll just go ahead and put up the money and we'll make sure we get this appeal done. And so that first part of the lawsuit in district court ran about 5,000. On the appeal to the appellate court, by the time that was done with asking for the rehearing, was about 11,000. And what happened in the appellate court they sat there and decided that they're going to overturn three or four Alabama statutory laws, and they're also going to go against a 2008 Supreme Court, Alabama Supreme Court ruling, and several other Supreme Court rulings. And it was kind of like, it looked like somebody got a hold of our suit up there and decided, oh, well, we want the Homeowner Association to win, and let's figure out how to write it up where they can. And I've shared these documents with you. I don't know if you've dug into them enough to see what's going on, but I shared them with some friends of mine that are attorneys, and everybody that sees this stuff just laughs. It's almost comical what they did in the appellate court. So here's our next step. Well, you know, after they've made that ruling, our appellate attorney, Ken Lay, out of Birmingham, who specializes in appellate work, he said that his recommendation was that we ask for a rehearing. And I said,
A rehearing at the appellate level or at the lower court level?
Right, at the appellate level.
At the appellate level, okay.
And my question to him, and of course I'm not real well versed on appellate procedures and stuff, and I asked him, I said, educate me, this is a learning process for me. And he said, well, he said, when we file a writ of certiorari with the Supreme Court, he said, it's going to look more favorable if we've asked them for a rehearing.
Okay.
I said, all right. I said, you do this for a living, so I'm going to take your advice. And so that's what we did. And I asked him, I said, how long will this take? And he told me, he said, we ought to hear from them probably a month and a half, 2 months. So we wait and wait and wait. 10 months. And then we hear from them. They had an option of reversing their initial opinion or writing something in support of the original opinion, or they could have just said, nah, we're not going to hear it. And so that's what they did. They said, nope, we're not hearing it. They didn't write anything, didn't give any reasons, nothing.
So there was no opinion attached to that. There was just no, we're not going to do that.
Right. That's
which tells me that they're going to stick by their guns.
They're sticking to their original opinion.
Right.
And, you know, they didn't give any reasons. And we brought up quite a few reasons, you know, where we saw that it was in conflict with other Supreme Court rulings and conflict with statutory laws and things of that nature. So
was there any, and I don't remember reading any constitutional arguments in there. I didn't read word for word, but I went through all of the documents and kind of scanned them and read major portions of them, because quite often there's a lot of repetition in these documents. You sent me five documents, but I don't recall seeing anything about the constitutional arguments in there. Was there?
No, it's all based in basically statutory law and Supreme Court rulings. And if you look at the statutory law, it's the law that governs Alabama nonprofit corporations.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things, one of the laws in there, and I can't recall exactly which number it is, but it says that, a nonprofit corporation cannot hold its members liable for its debts or obligations. Well, when they try to bill us for dues, they're trying to hold us liable for their debts and obligations. And when we had the restrictive covenants now, the restrictive covenants is what gave them the power to do this. And another thing that, and this gets really complicated, that it the corporation is set up to run in perpetuity. In other words, it never expires. Somebody has to dissolve it. And that for it to be a covenant itself and be tied to the property violates the law against perpetuities. And that, don't ask me to explain that one, because I barely understand enough of it to get it straight in my mind, much less be able to tell somebody else about it.
And okay, but the thing is that in your governing, in your covenants, in the declaration that came with the, that attached to the property, it says that it may be terminated or changed in whole or in part. So you have that right. You have the ability with a 60% affirmative vote.
Right, that's the restrictive covenant.
Right.
Yeah, and we've dissolved those.
So that's gone.
And right, that's gone.
And there's a hierarchy of documents, and usually it's the covenants, because covenants form the basis of the contract. A covenant in its broadest term means a contract. So
exactly.
That's your contract, and it's gone.
That's what all my lawyers and my buddies that are lawyers that I talk to, that's what they all say. And the thing about it is they never challenged us dissolving the restrictive covenants. What they did was they decided to put the liens in place. And what that did was cause us to have to sue them rather than them to have to sue us in order to get a court's clarification on this. Well, also what it did was it drug the time frame out for all of this stuff to happen past the 2-year mark of when we had, had dissolved the covenants. And that 2-year mark, what that did was stop them from being able to bring that up as an issue in court. In other words, the time had lapsed for them to bring any action over us, questioning whether or not we properly dissolved the covenants or whether or not we had the power or anything like that. So they, they shot themselves in the foot if they wanted to question any of that. And that was by letting the 2-year time frame pass.
Well, they probably knew that that was a losing cause, that there was no way they were going to win on that.
Right. And prior to us doing that, there had been some talk, and they were saying, if anybody's going to do any of that, you're going to have a 60% vote of the entire subdivision. And when I sat down and started reading the covenants, I looked at it and said, no, that ain't right. That they either have not asked for anybody to give them a legal opinion on that, or they were not capable of sitting down and reading and comprehending the English language, because it's pretty simple when you sit down and read it. You didn't have a problem when you read it, did you?
No, I didn't have a problem, but I've been doing this for a while. We're talking to Larry Fletcher, who's the homeowner in Alabama in a neighborhood in an association or a former association called Fairfield Place Homeowners Association. And unlike what we've been told, he's not happy with the association. So he and his neighbors, about 90% of them, signed a document dissolving their section of the association. Now, it's one of 5 sections, right?
Well, dissolved our restrictive covenants.
Yeah. Well,
yeah,
basically,
and
so you dissolve the
association. Right. Each unit has their own set of restrictive covenants, and we dissolved ours, which is what we had control over.
Okay. So, I think that's fantastic. I think that's absolutely brilliant, because so many people are out there tweaking associations. They're trying to make them work. They're trying to reform them. They're trying to make them good. While you looked at it and said, we just want to be left alone. From what I understand, there are no common areas attached to your unit or your segment, your section of 11 houses.
This property bordered two county roads, and so it was a big corner piece of property. And the first unit, what they did was just divided up 1,200-foot wide, 200-foot deep lots that faced County Road 13. And so, you know, the road was already there. All they had to do was have an engineer come out and figure out where to put all the property stakes, install a water line, and the electric line was already there, and they could start building houses on that and didn't have to put in any streets. And so, yeah, it made sense for them to do that with the first one. But then you round the corner and go to the next phase, which is phase two, or unit two, and they had to put the street in and all the underground street drainage and all that, and they developed it, and then they've got a pond, and it's a retention pond that streets drain into.
Right.
And the third unit is spaced all around the, they call it a lake, but it's really a pond, and those houses are around it, and then on beyond that, you've got units four and five. But that gives you a little bit of a idea of how the area actually looks. And the common area is basically the pond, a little bit of area around the pond. There's a little bit of common area there at the entrance to Unit 2. And I'm going to say the entrance to Unit 3 and the Unit 5. And that's all the entrances to that part of the subdivision. And each one of those entrances has got a sign, and it's got some bushes and a little bit of grass and stuff like that. So basically that's what they maintain, is those entryways, and mow the grass around the pond and go out there and try to kill the weeds in it every now and then, and things like that.
Larry, how many homes, how many lots in the entire association? Not just in your unit, but all five units put together.
In the neighborhood of 150 to 160.
Okay.
That's one of those figures that I knew at one time, but I would have to go back and look it up again to refresh my memory.
Okay, so basically you're just a very small section of the entire association.
Right.
And you just said, okay, we're dropping off.
Yeah, we're a dozen lots in Unit 1, and let's see, Unit 2 is 31 or 33, and then Unit 3 is bigger.
It doesn't matter. I just wanted an idea of how large the entire place was. So you're not really talking about half the members dropping off. You're talking about a very small section saying, we just want to be left alone.
Right.
Okay. Right.
And there's a lot of people that are disturbed with the association and what's going on. And I would imagine there's some people in the other units that have got their eyes on us and seeing what kind of trail we're going to blaze. But they did elect a new fella to run the HOA, and he's been keeping a pretty low profile through all of this. And they've not been nearly as activist as they were before.
What were they doing before? Why did you decide you wanted to just secede from the rest of it?
Well, the president of the Homeowners Association would drive up and down the street every day and just looking for a reason to come pick on somebody. And they came up with, oh, we can see your air conditioner from the street. Well, yeah, it's partially hidden by a bush or something like that. And he was sending out letters that telling everybody they had to go build little fences so that he couldn't see the air conditioner.
Oh,
then there was something in the restrictive covenants about the roof jacks had to be same color as the house. Well, you got lead covers that go over these roof jacks. What we're talking about is the vent stacks for the plumbing system.
Oh, okay.
And you'll notice those when you drive by a house and you look and you say, oh, yeah, they got a little pipe sticking up out of the roof. Well, that's what we're talking about.
Oh, okay.
And they had these lead covers on them, and, which is fairly common practice. And they get a little bit whitish in color. They don't have that original dark gray lead color after a few years. So they're wanting people to get up on the roof and paint these things. Well, you just show us a paint that'll stick to that lead cover, you know, and that's where that starts. So they backed off of that because they found out that there wasn't any paint that would stick to it.
So it's nitpicky and stuff.
Yeah, and just, they're picking the specks out of the fly mess. And they one of the other things was satellite dishes, and they're wanting to dictate where people's satellite dishes can go, and you know, oh, it can go on the side of the house, but we've got one of the fellows in the other area of the subdivision, he's on a corner lot, and so he puts it on the side of his house. Well, you can see it when you turn the corner. And so I did some digging around on the internet and found the Telecommunications Act of 1996, where it said that was the FCC's jurisdiction and that they couldn't tell you where to put your satellite dish. And I sent a copy of that over to the guy in the other section, and they backed off of him, you know, once they found out that they didn't have authority on that. Another thing they did, my neighbor, his air conditioner went out during the summer, and I don't know about where you are, but our summers can get pretty hot down here. We're in the extreme southern part of Alabama. We're about halfway between I-10 and the Gulf Coast on the east shore of the Mobile Bay. So you know how hot and humid it gets in the summer.
Oh, yeah.
And so what my neighbor does, he's got the air conditioning guy over there pulling his air conditioner out, and he brings his motorhome over there so that him and his wife can stay in it while they're repairing the air conditioner, because it's probably 90 degrees and 85% or so humidity. And these are older people that are retired. And the president of the Homeowners Association sends him a nasty letter about his motorhome being there. It drives by and sees it, send him a nasty letter. Seems like it had a picture along with it, too. Instead of pulling in the driveway and knocking on the door and saying, well, Bill, what's going on here with the motorhome? Now, go back and send off a nasty letter. And I think anybody that has got any kind of reason about him would say, well, yeah, his air conditioner's out. He brought his motorhome over there so that they could, you know, get in out of the heat. And it's obvious the air conditioner repair company's got their truck up in the front yard and their tools stretched out, and they're working on replacing the air conditioner. This ain't rocket science.
Yeah.
You know, but that's the sort of stuff that we were dealing with, and that's what pushed us to decide to go ahead and take the action we did, because we said, you know, look, even if you get this guy out and you get a guy in that's more favorable, you still have a mechanism and an apparatus set up for one of these crazy guys to get back in there and go around and cause people grief.
You're absolutely correct. You're absolutely correct. People tweak it and they think, well, we get rid of this guy, we put someone else in, oh, everything's honky-dory, but the mechanism, the venue is still there. And as we like to say on this show, you're one election away from having
right.
Everything turn around again.
That's exactly right. And as long as you have a system where somebody can come and harass the other people that are involved, then that in itself is the problem, is that the system is in place. You know, it's I can remember conversations with my father talking about politicians, and he'll say, "Oh, would you got to get a good morally straight politician, and that's how you get things straightened out." And I said, "No, what you need to do is create a system that's got the politician so caged that you can get the sorriest, low-down, crookedest one that you can find, and you can stick him in there, and he still can't do any damage." And I said, if you set up the system that way, if that guy all of a sudden gets religion and decides to turn good, well, you can handle that. It's not a big problem. You get the good guy in there, and you got the you have the screwed up system, and the good guy turns bad. Well, you're screwed. You know.
Well, I think that's what they call the chains of the Constitution, but unfortunately, nobody's enforcing that.
Right. They ignore that. I remember it was one of these columnists when they had written an article, and it might have been a comedian, though. But anyway, he was talking about the people that were trying to put together a constitution for Iraq several years back. And he said, "Well, won't we just send them ours? We don't use it anyway."
Yeah, I remember that. I absolutely remember that, yeah. They can have ours. Wasn't that Jay Leno?
Was it him? Might have been Leno. Might have been George Carlin.
It might have been, yeah. It might have been one of those. We'll just send it to them that we're not using it.
Uh-huh.
I remember that, yes. So you looked at that and you decided, you know what, we don't need this. We just want to be left alone. We're tired of being abused, harassed, nitpicked to death, getting all these threat letters. And we're not gaining any benefit from the association. So, adios association.
That's pretty much what we did. And I don't know, I found it I found it kind of interesting that we're going through this fight, and if what my appellate attorney tells me is that if we can get the attention of the Supreme Court, he said, then they'll look at this, and he feels pretty confident about it. He said that when you appeal to the Supreme Court with what they call a writ of certiorari, which what I remember from his definition when I asked him to define a writ of certiorari, he told me that basically you're telling the Supreme Court, hey, y'all need to look at this because it's in conflict with these statutory laws, and it's in conflict with these other precedents, which are Supreme Court rulings. And, you know, that if you can write the thing strong enough and jump through all the hoops, and there's a whole bunch of rules that go along with this. So in what I have learned about appellate law is, you better have somebody that is familiar with it and does it on a regular basis. Because lawyers that normally appear just in district court and hadn't done that much appellate work, they can get tripped up by all the picky little rules. Because depending on what side you are, tells you what color binder that you have to use for your brief. And that's just one of them that sticks out in my mind that most people will say, really?
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and ours was red, and I forget what color the other side was. But anyway, there's a whole bunch of little rules like that. And a friend of mine who's an attorney that fights a lot of the big banks, and he's not involved in this case, but I just asked him, I said, tell me a little bit about appeals and what I should expect. And he said, appellate law, he said, that's a whole nother animal. He said, you need to have somebody that specializes in that. And I said, well, do you do that? And he said, no. He said, all my appellate work is handled by Ken Lay out of Birmingham. And I said, well, how you been doing? He said, well, he's won 11 of the last 12 cases that we've had go before the Supreme Court. And I said, well, that sounds like my man. And he gave me his phone number, and that's how I got in touch with Ken.
And he's going to take it?
Oh, he's the one that's done the appeal, and he's the one that's filing the writ of certiorari.
Cool. And so he's
we've had him working for us for 2.5-3 years, however long this has been going on now, since we got out of the district court.
So, what does he think the odds are for you winning this, or what does he think the odds are for the Supreme Court to take this case or to hear the case?
He said normally that's about a 50-50 chance.
Okay.
And he doesn't like to give you a lot of odds on stuff. Because I was pressing him for that the other day, and I said, well, Ken, I said, it sounds like you're telling me you'd rather practice law than gamble. And he said, yeah.
I like that.
Yeah.
Well,
so,
I understand lawyers are loath to tell you, you know, we've got a great chance of doing this. But you must have a feeling about it. Obviously, he feels that you've got a good case, otherwise he wouldn't be taking it, I'm assuming.
Yeah, exactly. He feels like we've got a good case, and he's very good at what he does. Got a great track record. And also, he's got the biggest trait that I see in really good lawyers. And here's how I determine whether you've got a good lawyer or not. That's one that when you start reading up on some law yourself so that you can go in and ask them intelligent questions, that they're not offended by that. And they'll say, oh, yeah, well, let me help you a little and educate you, and yeah, and I'll discuss this in more legal terms with you, and you know, stop me if you don't understand. When you got one that'll work with you like that, then that's generally what I find is a good lawyer that's going to be honest. When you get one that is offended that you went and read about a few cases and then came back and asked him, well, What about Smith versus Jones, where they ruled in the appellate court this way in 1998? If that offends them, then run. Find one that's not offended.
that's a good way of looking at it.
Yeah, because I've found the ones that are offended by that, generally they don't do their homework and they just wing it. And we've got half a dozen people here that are scouring the internet, looking at cases, looking at laws, and we email this stuff back and forth to each other, and we say, hey, what do you think? You know, this case looks similar to ours. What do you think? And we'll look at it and decide, yeah, they got some merits in there that are similar to our case, and then we'll forward it on to our attorney. And they'll take a look at it and they'll say, yeah, I think we can use some of that as a case we can cite. Or they'll tell us, no, that one really doesn't apply to you, and here's why, and they'll explain it to us. And so it's nice to have one that'll work with you like that.
Yeah. And you know what's going on.
Yeah. If you walk in there and. I compare going to an attorney to going to a doctor. You don't walk in the doctor's office, write him a check, and he gives you some kind of diagnosis that you've got a severe illness, and you just march on off and do whatever he says. No. You got some severe illness, you're back home, you're on the internet, you're looking it up, you're finding out what other doctors and people say, And so when you see him again, you're informed, and you can ask him some questions.
Yeah.
You can say, hey, they're treating this with these three different drugs. What do you think? You know, and that's what you do. And I find that you need to work with lawyers the same way.
Larry, you say you've been doing all this research, and there's a number of you that are scouring the Internet. Have you found any cases that are exactly on point to yours? In other words, how many other people have dissolved their HOAs or have extinguished their covenants and said, hands off, we're free? Have you run into any more of those?
We've not been able to find any precedent that where you could say, oh, yeah, this is a sister case to ours. We've had trouble even finding some of them that say, yeah, they look like we found one that's a second cousin to yours. And that's with us looking and with lawyers and their legal staffs looking.
We have one in Virginia.
Oh, really?
We have one in Virginia, the Ferran case. And they went through the court system for a number of different reasons. Again, it all starts out with a nitpicky association that decides they're going to run your life for you because you're not mature or adult enough to take care of yourself. And they ended up in the court, and they won every case. In Virginia, the law says that the prevailing party to a case is entitled to reasonable fees and costs. They won every single one of their cases because every time they did something, the association came back and did something else. And so it was in court for a number of years. In fact, I did interview them a couple of times. And when it was all over with, the association was bankrupt because they would not take no for an F. They just said, you know, okay, we lose, we screwed up, we'll make it up to you. No, they just kept pushing and pushing and pushing. And so the Ferrans ended up in court for a number of years. They won. The association had to pay them for all of their court costs, and the judge awarded them every penny they asked for. So the association was bankrupt. They filed bankruptcy. And they wanted to sell the one bit of common land that they had to pay the Ferrans back. Somehow they got the money and they paid that back. But in the process, what they did was they gutted. They didn't extinguish the association, but the entire association got together and they gutted the covenants. So there are no restrictive covenants. There's nothing. The association cannot tell them to do this, that, or the other. The association still exists. And they're there to maintain the common area, remove the snow, because although we have really hot, humid summers here, we also get snow and ice. And to maintain that one strip, 1 acre bit of common area. But otherwise, the association, the covenants were pretty well gutted.
Well, that was an option for us to gut the covenants to remove their power. But we also decided that we didn't want to be associated with them and didn't want to have to pay their dues either.
Well, you had a different scenario, so it worked really well for you because you didn't have any common area. There was nothing there, right?
Right, we didn't have any in this area.
And your covenants were specific to your unit, to the 12 houses.
Right, and the common areas that exist in the other parts of the subdivision, we don't get any benefit from them. We don't use them. Those are not our entrances. You know, we go down a couple of county roads to get home.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's separated, and if you came out here and we got in a car and drove down the road and I showed you that, you'd say, oh yeah, okay, I see that's a nice subdivision over there. And then you turn down our road and you see these dozen lots, and it's one vacant lot and 11 houses. You'd look at it and you'd say, oh, really? That's a part of that other subdivision we just passed by?
Yeah.
And I'd tell you, yeah, and you'd say, well, it sure doesn't look like it.
Yeah, I live in something like that as well, where we're kind of separated from the bulk of the association.
And one of the things about the restrictive covenants was that we could, it stated in the restrictive covenants that we could not amend the restrictive covenants in order to take ourselves out of the association. You know, that we were obligated, that was in the restrictive covenants themselves. But it also said in there that we had the right to terminate.
Yes.
And I believe it was, I believe terminate was the
I copied it down, yeah, maybe terminated or changed in whole or in part.
Right. And, but it's further down in there, it says that you can't, amend the covenants in order to get away from the association. And that's why we chose to terminate them. And I remember talking with a lawyer that drew up the documents and I said, look, let's use the exact language here, the terminate. And I told him this is why, because, you know, it says we can't amend them to get out, so we have to terminate them. And he looked at it and agreed. And there's, of course, a bunch of case law about restrictive covenants and documents of this nature, and it'll tell you that, yeah, that these things, literally, they mean what they say, and, you know, that these words mean something, and to be interpreted literally, and stuff like that. So that's how we read it, you know, and interpreted it that way. And a lot of people are, they'll read something, and they'll say, oh, I get what they're wanting me to do here. You know, this is kind of what they are meaning, and they read over it. And if you're going to attack the association and try to take power away from them and do stuff like that, you can't read it and get the general meaning of what they're trying to tell you. You got to sit there and look at that thing like, okay, where's the loophole? You know, where does it allow me some wiggle room? And you go over all those documents with a fine tooth comb, which is what we've done. And if you get to reading in the Articles of Organization, you'll find out that the Articles of Organization for the Homeowners Association say that it applies to Unit 2. And it says other property may be added, such as Units 1 and Units 3.
And were they added? Were they added?
No, they weren't. And so what we...
interesting.
So if you've got Articles of Organization, and we ask ourselves, well, how would you add property to this nonprofit corporation, which is what it is, and say, okay, it's in Alabama. Well, let's look at Alabama nonprofit corporation law. And one of the laws in there, I read it, and it's fairly easy to understand. It says that the Articles of Organization may be amended. And then it goes and cites several different reasons for why you might amend the Articles of Organization. One of them is to reflect a change in membership. So, there we go. Statutory law written by the legislature, signed by the governor. And, you know, so this don't even get into anything complex like case law. And the articles were not amended. Well, when this was pointed out to them, the Homeowners Association, they decided, well, we'll just amend the bylaws. Okay, so they amended the bylaws and named all these other units in the bylaws.
And they can't do that because they're two entirely different documents.
Entirely different documents. So
with hierarchy of documents as well.
Let's go back to the good old state of Alabama law.
Okay.
And we start digging around in the nonprofit corporation law again. Well, here we go. Talking about bylaws. And it says in there, if there is a conflict between the bylaws and the articles,
mm-hmm.
the articles are the controlling document.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you, for the people out there that haven't dug into anything like this, most of the states now have got all of their statutory law on a website. And generally, once you find the website and get to it where you got it, you're going to spend a few hours picking around through it, looking at it till you kind of get the feel, oh, okay, I kind of see how they got this structured, and you start to find things. And it's quite interesting, and you can go in there and look up just a whole host of different things, and you can see for yourself what the law says about it. And it's really not that difficult, and if it's anything that you might have the slightest interest in, you'll find it very entertaining, you know, to do it, because I mean I enjoy doing it.
Well, it sounds like you've learned a whole lot over the course of the time that you've been working on this. When did you first start dissolving or extinguishing the covenants in your case? How long has it been? How long of a process?
Oh, let's see. This is 14. I want to say it was about 3 years, 3 or 4 years ago.
Okay.
Yeah, this stuff's been going on for a while, and of course, you know, I'm old enough now where somebody says, how long ago was that? And I said, well, you know, that's about a year ago, and I get to looking, and it was three.
I understand.
Yeah.
I understand. Time has a way of flying faster and faster, doesn't it?
Yeah, it was like around February or March when we did it, and I'm looking at our circuit court number, which is 11, or 2011, so that was in 2011, so it must have been 2010, I'll say.
Okay, so it's been not an overnight thing. You've been working at this for a while. We're not going to have time. I wanted to get into the fining issue because you did say that the first lawsuit was about fining, but we only have a couple more minutes for the show. Would you believe time flies? Yes.
Well, time flies when you're having fun.
Time flies, and I wish you all the luck. I know that you're looking for amicus briefs, amicus curiae, friends of the court. So if I have any attorneys who are listening, who want to file something, contact me, yes?
Okay, yeah, that would be great. And
well, unfortunately, wait a minute, it's due by Friday, right?
Right, this Friday, June the 6th.
This will air on the 7th, so forget I said that.
That's when my attorney tells me, and I don't know, they've always got some kind of exception, and I would just, I would have to find out from him if, hey, we got a guy here that's a few days late, and they got all kind of little ways to bend the rules. But I don't know what they all are.
Well, the thing is, you're requesting this, so the Supreme Court hasn't actually agreed to look at the case.
No, they have. Friday is our deadline for basically asking the question, hey, Supreme Court, will you take a look at this for us?
Okay, so once they've accepted and you've actually filed, then I think you can start looking for more amicus briefs.
No, as I understood what Ken Lay, my appellate attorney, was telling me, is that the amicus briefs need to be filed at the same time that we file the writ of certiorari, which the deadline for that is Friday.
Okay. All right. So you're going to do that.
Yeah.
You're going to file that. Good luck, Larry. Show us how it's done. I want to put you up as a model child. Poster child for people who are fed up with their HOAs and decides that they're going to put an end to it. Not tweak it, not fix it, not reform it, but put an end to it.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you taking the time to talk with me and to hear our story and to share it with other people. And I hope that we can inspire some others out there that are going through similar situations.
Well, I hope you keep in touch with me. Let me know how it's going, what you're doing, and come back when it's all over with and you've
okay.
got a winning story to tell.
Well, let's definitely stay in touch. I know I've talked to you a time or two over the past few days and really enjoyed the conversations.
Thanks, Larry. Thanks to all of you for joining us.
Please check out our website at onthecommons.us. On the Commons is produced by OTC Multimedia Productions.
Well, I finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect, all my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs, life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Now there's lots of open meetings close to justice for HO. Those arrogant board members say what they want you to know. The CAI and ULI will help you lose it all. But I wouldn't sell that dream home yet, the writing's on the wall. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Well, we're not afraid or stupid, all your threats mean nothing here. Time marches on, soon you'll be gone, united we'll be there. So put your rules and CCRs up where the sun don't shine, and enjoy those precious golden years, stop messing around with mine. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.